This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I'm afraid I should start this interview by apologizing for having used a styrofoam cup today. Like so many Americans, I've become increasingly aware of how my personal consumer choices affect the environment. Well, if you're horrified by the styrofoam cup, don't give up on me. I'm buying a lot less bottled water at home because of all the carbon emissions from the plastic bottles and the shipping. Instead, I'm filling a pitcher with filtered tap water. So here's the thing. If you want to make smart consumer choices and buy products that haven't resulted in excessive greenhouse gas emissions, well, how do you know exactly what the emissions are? The answers are often difficult to calculate and sometimes counterintuitive. My guest, Michael Spector, writes about science for The New Yorker. In the current edition, he has an article about the difficulties of measuring carbon footprints. It's called Bigfoot. Michael Spector, welcome back to Fresh Air. Let's just start with the real basics. What is meant by a carbon footprint?
A carbon footprint is a relatively simple concept. It's just the amount of global warming that you contribute to the globe through whatever else you do.
Through the carbon emissions caused by whatever product you're using at the moment or whatever action you're taking.
Yes, it's carbon emissions. It's also other greenhouse gases, though carbon seems to have become the shorthand for them all.
Now, I learned from your article that there are some foods and products that are starting to have carbon footprint labels. So why are they doing this?
Well, some organizations are trying to figure out how they can help consumers to make better choices about being environmentally sound. And Tesco, about a year ago, which is Britain's biggest grocery chain, decided that they would attempt to label all their products so people in the stores could figure out what they wanted to buy. And they're attempting to do that now. It's an extremely complicated process and possibly a bit more complicated than they had ever imagined.
Yeah, let's talk about how complicated it is. What are some of the dilemmas in figuring out how to measure the carbon footprint?
When it comes to something like food, for instance, people would often think that food grown locally would have a smaller carbon footprint than food that has been sent in from many miles away. And that is sometimes, maybe even often, the case, but it's not always the case because you need to look at the fertilizer that's used, the land that's used, whether there's a lot of sun, whether there's a lot of water used, what kind of gas is used in transporting something, was it shipped by air or sea? All these things contribute to the carbon footprint. It isn't simply just how far the thing was driven in order for you to eat it. And it can be rather complicated, and it even varies depending upon the season.
It can be very counterintuitive. Give us an example of a real counterintuitive comparison of locally grown produce and something shipped in from far away, where the far away one has the lower carbon footprint.
Well, one that surprised me was Cranfield University in England is doing studies on this. It's called life cycle analysis. And they recently did a life cycle analysis of roses shipped in from Kenya and compared them to roses shipped from Holland, each to London. You would think that the Holland roses would win by a mile, but in fact, the Holland roses had a 6 times heavier carbon footprint than those sent from Kenya, even though the Kenyan ones were sent by air. And the reason is, when you grow a rose in Holland, you do it in a greenhouse, and the greenhouse is heated, and that takes energy, and the transportation is not as efficient. And when you added it all up, it was much better to buy your roses and ship them in from Kenya.
You know, it gets really confusing. Like, exactly what do you include when you're measuring a product's carbon footprint? Like, you give the example of a jar of peanut butter. What are some of the questions you have to ask about what's included before you can actually come up with a measure of the carbon footprint?
I think this is the problem. You kind of have to include everything. When you look at a carbon footprint, people often talk about, gee, how far are you driving? Well, that matters. Obviously, it matters a lot. But if you're looking at a jar of peanut butter trying to figure out its carbon footprint, you have to think about things like how much energy went into making the jar, how much energy went into printing the paper label and putting it on the jar, how much energy went into taking those jars and delivering them to your local store. What kind of peanuts were used? How were the peanuts boiled? What was the fertilizer used? All these things actually matter a lot. And when you add it up, sometimes it comes out to a number that's different than the one you might intuitively have thought.
Are there any common ground rules for how to do this? Because I can easily see a situation where we're measuring carbon footprints, but each brand is measuring it differently.
Well, that's what Tesco, the British supermarket chain, had in mind when it wanted to develop a universal label. They're working on it. Other people are, too. It's early days. It's not an easy thing to do, but they're trying to develop a universal label. And I think that will happen fairly soon. The question is, will those labels be of tremendous value? And sometimes they will. If you're living in Philadelphia or New York, and you're shipping your water in from Fiji or Paris, probably that is environmentally more destructive than getting your water at home. Those things are intuitive and they're true. But the problem is that it's not always the case. You can't always follow your intuition. If you're in New York and you want to drink wine, you're much better off drinking Bordeaux than California Cabernet. I'm sorry, California. It's not a taste judgment. It's just that California wines tend to be shipped by truck. Bordeaux tend to be shipped by boat, and boats are much more energy efficient.
Wait, and you're saying if you live in New York, because you could get it right off the boat if you live in New York, but if you're in Chicago, then it still probably will go by truck after it gets to the States by boat, right?
Chicago is about the borderline. I think in the study that I saw, they decided that Columbus, Ohio was the very place where it started to make more sense to drink California wine than to drink French wine.
Okay, so you get into a situation where you're getting these carbon footprint labels on products, and then you have to ask, well, it's going to be different for New York and Columbus and Chicago and San Francisco. It's so complicated.
It is, and I personally think that's why carbon labeling is something we ought to be careful about. I think it's really important that we think about our carbon footprint and we think about how we can make it lower, because that's a crisis. Every single thing we eat and every single thing we do, we don't need to sit with a calculator, in the same way that I doubt it benefit from looking at the calories of every single food we eat every day. But it is good to know what our nutritional needs are and when we're exceeding them.
Another example of something that seems really counterintuitive in terms of the carbon footprint of a food that is shipped long distance is imported apples from New Zealand. What's the story?
Well, one would think if you were growing apples, say, in upstate New York, if you lived in New York or not far from London, those apples would be environmentally much more friendly than apples, say, shipped in from New Zealand. But again, that's not always the case, because in New Zealand, they use less land. There's more sun. The energy they do use is usually solar or geothermal energy, which is clean. Whereas in America, we use dirty energy, more water, more heat is required for the orchards, more manure and other fertilizers that are carbon intensive. And in the end, it's not always the case that the apples next door are environmentally better for you than the apples from thousands of miles away.
But it is often the case that the apples next door are better for you.
It's sometimes it's true and sometimes it isn't. Unfortunately, there's no 100% way to make these judgments. By no means am I suggesting that we ought not to grow food locally or eat food that's grown near home. It usually tastes better. It often is better, and it often has an environmental ticket that's lower. It's just not always the case.
Are there companies in the meantime that are developing methods of measuring carbon footprints, hoping that this idea really takes off in marketing?
Yes, there are, but I think not necessarily in the way that you imply. There are a bunch of companies that are trying to help people become carbon neutral, to lower their carbon footprint. And some of those companies are great, and some are fly-by-night organizations taking advantage of the fact that we're in an environmental crisis where we don't have a lot of information.
My guest is Michael Spector. He writes about science for The New Yorker. His article about the difficulty of measuring carbon footprints is in the current edition. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Spector. He writes about science for The New Yorker, and his new piece in the current edition is called Bigfoot. In measuring carbon emissions, it's easy to confuse morality and science. Now, some people are taking a marketing approach to controlling emissions. Like, there's a place called the Chicago Climate Exchange where members buy and sell, as you put it, the right to pollute. Can you explain how that works?
First of all, the Chicago Climate Exchange is an exchange like any other, like pork belly futures or gold or mortgage-backed securities. That's a bad example since they're not doing well. But it's the same principle. And the principle is that there's a certain amount of carbon emissions, pollution, that has to occur if we're going to function in the world. Let's figure out a limit. Let's figure out lines that we cannot cross. and assign them. When you cross the line, you have to pay for it. If you go below the line, you get a credit and you can sell that credit. And this started with acid rain in the 80s. In the United States in the 80s, we had a terrible problem with acid rain. The climate exchange started to sell sulfur dioxide permits. The United States government set limits. If you went above the limits, you had to pay. It soon became very, very clear that the way to go was to make your factories far more efficient and cut your pollution. It costs less to do that, and acid rain is not a problem in our country as a result, or not a terrible problem.
So taking a cue from that, what's happening now?
Well, people are looking at it in the same way, and they're saying, should there be a line and a legal limit? And when you cross the legal limit, should you have to buy shares? And if you are able to keep yourself below that limit, should you be able to sell them? And it seems to work quite well.
So would you describe a little bit more about how this idea of a climate exchange works?
Say you're a factory in the Midwest and you're emitting a certain 30 tons of some sort of pollutant. We set up a system that says, gee, you can only pollute 20 tons worth. If you pollute 21 tons, you have to pay a penalty. So that factory then has to decide, is it going to continue to pollute and pay the money? Or is it going to possibly pay a bunch of money for new technology or figure out new technologies and go below the level? And when that penalty is high enough, when things cost enough, people go below the limits and they cut out the carbon pollution. One of the problems we have is that carbon is not really valued, and therefore there's no incentive not to pollute.
So how much is this trend catching on?
Well, it would catch on a lot more if there was an administration in the United States that supported it. The United States is the world's biggest polluter, though some people say China has either caught up or surpassed us, but we're pretty bad, and the Bush administration has not been helpful on this issue. The next presidential administration almost certainly will pass legislation. John McCain, Hillary Clinton, and Barack Obama are all co-sponsors of a cap-and-trade bill now before Congress.
So what does the cap-and-trade bill have to say?
You can't really have one of these exchanges that works unless there's some sort of penalty that matters. And the only way you can have a penalty is to have a law. So this would establish a law saying, you go above this limit and you got to buy the right to go above that limit. And if such a law exists and is enforced, and it is enforced and enforceable usually, then it just becomes too expensive. A company can't afford it. Their goods would end up costing too much. We wouldn't buy them. I mean, it's not even, it is a moral issue, but we're not even looking at it in that respect right now. It's just an economic issue.
One of the approaches being taken now to keep the carbon footprint of products low is public pressure. You give us an example, the Greenpeace campaign called Green My Apple. What was this campaign?
They were upset because Apple Computer was not as environmentally friendly as you would want it to be. In fact, when they did surveys, Apple routinely came in last. Now, Apple likes to think of itself as one of the most innovative brands in the United States, and it wants to have a clean image. So this was pretty embarrassing, and Greenpeace and other organizations really beat them to death over this. And when the iPhone came out, there was a lot of packaging that was just a waste. It was terribly wasteful. And Steve Jobs, in the end, put a notice up on the main website of Apple saying, we're going to do better, we're going to be a greener Apple, and this is how we're going to do it. And one of the ways he said they would do it is to use recycled goods when they use packaging. And another important thing they're doing is they're kind of moving away from some of the environmentally unfriendly monitors towards LCD screens, which are less damaging.
Because the other screens have things like arsenic and mercury in them?
They do. And the point here is that
I said screens. I should say monitors. I don't know if it's the screen or something else that actually has the arsenic and mercury.
It's a little of both. Mm-hmm. But the point here is that if people put pressure on, it matters. I mean, if you're going to go buy a computer from another company because this company won't make a clean computer, it's going to stop. And if you embarrass a lot of companies, they're going to stop.
Now, there's ways each individual can cut down on their carbon footprint, but you point out that one of the really biggest problems, perhaps the biggest problem when it comes to carbon emissions, is the fact that The large rainforests, like in Brazil and in Indonesia, are just being lost at this incredible rate. Just give us an example of how rapidly rainforests are disappearing.
Deforestation accounts for about 20% of all carbon emissions, which is an amazing statistic. One person figured that the number of trees that are cut down every day in Indonesia are the carbon emissions equivalent of basically every person in London going to Heathrow Airport and getting on planes that very day and flying all together to New York. And it's just something, if you look at satellite photos, you'll see plumes of smoke rising into the sky from places like Indonesia, Brazil, the Congo, where forests are being clear cut and burned. And it's terrible for many reasons, but for the environment, it's particularly devastating.
And it's devastating not only because of the burning, but also the fact that the trees are gone.
There are two major sponges for carbon dioxide in our atmosphere, the oceans and the trees. The trees soak it up. If you get rid of the trees, not only do they not soak it up anymore, but they give off the emissions when they're burnt and cut down that they had absorbed. So it's a terrible loss. And it's often a needless loss because a lot of the clear cutting and the chopping and the clearing that's going on in places like Indonesia, it's really not necessary. It's really something that we ought to stop.
So what are some of the ways that have been proposed to stop this deforestation, stop the rate of it?
Well, one of the ways, again, and it's been proposed by some rather environmentally interesting groups, mostly on the left, they just say, hey, it's going to cost us $5 billion a year to pay these countries more money not to cut down their forests than they earn by cutting them down. Let's pay $5 billion a year. It's the best money the world could ever pay. And $5 billion a year, by the way, is a drop in the bucket of the cost of climate change. And so a variety of organizations, including countries, are now trying to figure out ways to just pay Indonesia more money not to cut down its forests than they're getting to do it.
Is anybody optimistic that this approach is going to happen where a coalition of countries or whatever pays the countries with the forests to leave the forests alone?
Yeah, many people are optimistic. I am one of those people. There's a bunch of coalitions working now, both on the country level and on the organizational level. The Carbon Canopy Group, the Rainforest Coalition, and they're getting corporations, governments, and intergovernmental groups to agree that this is something they ought to do, and they're figuring out financial ways that make sense to do it.
Give us a sense of some of the deadlines that we're up against with carbon emissions.
Most scientists agree that what we need to do right now is hold our emissions steady for about a decade. I don't think it's reasonable to assume that we'll cut them out right now. But at the end of a decade, if we don't start dropping by about 60 to 80% by the middle of this century, the consequences will be extremely, extremely drastic. And if we even put it off for a decade, just a decade, we will have to cut our emissions by twice as much as we do now. And that's going to be brutal. Right now, I think we can make some sacrifices. We can use technology. We can start paying attention to the world and we can solve the problem. But if we don't move now, we're not going to be able to solve the problem.
How does the United States compare to Europe and other countries in terms of getting a grip on greenhouse emissions?
Well, we're the worldwide bad boy because we didn't sign on to Kyoto. And the truth is, we were pretty bad and we could be a lot better, but we're doing better now. There's lots of individual initiatives on the state level, on the corporate level, on the individual level. There's tons of towns that care about this stuff. It's just that we need federal leadership and federal guidance, and we don't have it.
What are some of the things you've seen being done in, say, European countries that you think the United States can take a cue from?
Well, if you spend more money on things like wind power, solar energy, those things become effective if they have a critical mass. If you don't have a critical mass, they remain so expensive that nobody wants to do it. In Europe, people are spending a little bit more money, focusing a little bit more, making sure that something like wind power in Germany makes sense. We can do that all across the Midwest and large parts of this country. we can think about alternatives to gas and alternatives to driving. At this point, to drive as much as we do by ourselves in a car isn't just wasteful. It's been wasteful for a long time. It's criminal.
Michael, you've been writing about science for The New Yorker, but you had been a foreign correspondent for a long time. How have you liked covering the science beat?
I love it. It's the only, you know, I loved being overseas, but the only thing that I ever have written about that I never get bored of is science.
Uh-huh.
It's just so fascinating and complicated and interesting. And when I started being a journalist, you know, science writers were the geeky guys who couldn't cover the White House. As far as I'm concerned, that has completely changed. And what you ought to be, want to be as a science writer, it's the most interesting, important, and critical story of the time. The White House will take care of itself. Not the White House, but the coverage.
Michael Spector, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Michael Spector writes about science for The New Yorker. His article about the difficulties of measuring carbon footprints is in the current edition. He's about to take a leave from the magazine to write a book. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.